All right, the recorder is on. For those keeping score at home, my apologies that we didn't record last week's session.
Oh, man.
It was on the election of 1992. But just to recap for those who are listening on the audio, in 1992, Israel experienced its second mahapach, revolution in politics, except that maybe it wasn't really such a mahapach. Maybe it was just an ordinary turnover of administration that Likud, after 15 years, lost, and Labor was back in power. The final result was 44 votes for Labor, 32 votes for Likud, and 61-59 in favor of the left and Arabs against the right and religious. Okay, when Rabin was elected, on the night of the election, he made a speech saying, "I won, I'm going to rule, I'm going to govern, I'm going to make all the appointments, I'm the boss. I. Which is not the way that a prime ministerial candidate ordinarily operates in a parliamentary system, where they have to cobble together a coalition and have to hope that other junior members of the coalition will agree to whatever division of spoils the guy wants to hand out. Rabin, who had pretended as though this were a presidential contest rather than a prime ministerial one, and it was an Americanized type of election, he regarded himself as the victor who will determine, you know, all the outcomes going forward. Well, yeah, like the executive branch is independent of the legislature, which it's not. And he found that out fairly quickly, that he couldn't dictate terms. Well, one thing that he did that angered the most number of people was his appointment of Shulamit Aloni as the education minister. Shulamit Aloni is a radical secularist who was the leader of Meretz, and Meretz was the senior or the next largest partner in the coalition. If Labor had 44, Meretz had 12. Shas would have 6, they'd be the third member of the coalition. But Meretz was the linchpin. Without Meretz, there can't be a left-wing government. And they want the education portfolio because they would like to do what the religious want to do, and it is indoctrinate the young people. Except instead of indoctrinating them on God and Torah, it's indoctrinate them on whatever, the opposite of God and Torah. So the general public, and especially the religious public, was outraged over her appointment, and especially when she said certain anti-Judaic things. And so the word was going around in the right-wing circles that her appointment as education minister was equivalent to the destruction of the 1.5 million Jewish children in the Holocaust. Whoa! That's a bit much. And Rabin was that her appointment as education minister was the spiritual equivalent of the killing of 1.5 million Jewish children in the Holocaust. So that's an over-the-top comment, and Rabin was furious over that comment, and so he said, "She stays. The appointment stands. Any objection, I don't care. I don't like that kind of rhetoric. She's going to have her position." The other leading figure in Meretz was Yossi Sarid. Yossi Sarid was about to join the government as the environment minister, and bear in mind that Meretz had an element of the Green Party to it, so they care about the environment. but he was hesitant to join because he thought that Rabin was too hawkish. That yes, Rabin is the leader of the Labor Party, but he, Sarid, the good Meretzite that he is, believes in bold initiative in favor of peace with the Palestinians. And maybe the old General Yitzhak Rabin is not going to be aggressive enough in pursuing peace. To which Rabin quietly told him, "Don't worry, Yossi, I'm going to talk to the PLO. And Sarid was shocked, because for public consumption, that had always been denied, that there was not going to be discussion with the PLO, there would be other interlocutors. But privately, Rabin admitted he's willing to do it. So for the most part, Rabin got the cabinet that he wanted, for the most part. The one thing he didn't get was was a year later, for the election of the presidency, and I think maybe in June we're going to spend one session on the Israeli presidency, which we haven't spent much time at all on. Azer Weitzman ran against Dov Shalansky for the presidency, and Weitzman was the Labor Party's candidate, despite the fact that historically Weitzman had been a Likudnik, and only later gravitated further and further to the left. Rabin and Weitzman hated each other with a passion. After all, during the 1960s, during the Six-Day War, in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, Rabin made sure that Weizmann would not succeed him as chief of staff. And Weizmann never forgave him for that. So in 1974, he released all kinds of schmutz about Rabin, that Rabin had a breakdown, a mental breakdown, during the waiting period before the war broke out. And so there's a long 25-year bruggis between Ezer Weizmann and Yitzhak Rabin, but somehow Ezer became president. Yeah.
You never refer to the intramilitary fights, let's say, Air Force versus the regular army. Does that play a role?
It does, but not at the level of cabinet decision-making, for the most part. Typically not. So Rabin gets up there on the night of the election and gives a big speech in which he says that Israel has to lose their Masada complex and break out of their protective shell and go boldly for in the quest for peace. In his opening speech to the Knesset, after he presented the government, he said to the Palestinians, quote, "We offer you the fairest and most viable proposal from our standpoint today, autonomy with all of its advantages and limitations. You will not get everything you want, neither will we." So, it's a nice little speech. Interestingly, he says, "the most viable proposal from our standpoint today," which means, if you read between the lines, that maybe a more viable standpoint from a Palestinian perspective will exist among the Israelis tomorrow, the day after, the year after, which in fact would be the case. Definitely so. Things which were unfathomable in 1992 become almost certain in 1996 or 2000. Okay, so Yitzhak Shamir, who's sitting in the Knesset, and is still a member of the Knesset, despite resigning from the leadership of the Likud party, he says, quote, "What we have heard today mostly resembles a nihilistic philosophy which will cost us dearly in the long run." So that's the curmudgeonly Yitzhak Shamir. You could just envision him saying that any show of conciliation to the other side is a sign of weakness and it's going to cost us in the long run. That's Shamir for you. Now, by the way, what happens to Shamir? So he actually holds on to his seat in the Knesset for the full four-year term. He doesn't resign from the Knesset until 1996, but he's out of the Likud party leadership, as is normally the case when you lose. And so there's going to be an election to see who the replacement is. So last week, someone asked what happened to Moshe Arons. Moshe Arons resigned from the Knesset, and he wouldn't come back until 7 years later in the 99 election. He disappeared from politics for a while. So the race was between Bibi, Benny Begin, and David Levy. And Benny Begin never really stood a chance because he didn't have the charisma of his father. He didn't have the following that his father had, although it should be noted that Benny Begin is a very honest and decent and ideologically pure man. And we could say very nice things about him as a person, the likes of which you can't say about Bibi Netanyahu, even if you like his politics. So, and David Levy always overestimated his likability. And so he didn't do very well. He lost. BB won big. And for the next few years, David Levy will remain disgruntled, always looking for a moment when he could break away and form his own political party. Because what's the advantage of forming your own political party? That just in case the right side of the aisle wins the next election, you become indispensable. You're not number 37 on a list of 38 people. You're number one on a list of four people, but they need you, which will happen in 1996. So this is just a sideshow, because tonight is all about Labor and Rabin and Peres. I just wanted to give you an idea of what's happening in the Likud. Well, Rabin obsesses over the young generation in Israel, that they shouldn't have to go to war. And what's the symbol of the young generation? Who is the symbol of the young generation? She has a name. It's a three-letter name, at least in English, and in Hebrew too.
Gal Gadot?
No. Noah. His granddaughter, Noah. Noah Ben Artzi Pelosov, okay? She was 17 years old when he was assassinated, and he viewed her as representative of the next generation. He goes with her on a trip to Auschwitz, And the Holocaust never had really played any role in Rabin's existence because his parents came to Israel in the 19-teens, and he's born in 1922 in Jerusalem, so the Shoah was not part of his personal story. But he went to the concentration camps and was influenced by it, but he, you know, he wanted peace, peace for the world, peace for Israel. Correct, yes. Prior to him, everybody else was born somewhere else, in Poland or Russia. So, he focuses on peace to the exclusion of everything else, and basically delegates all other domestic issues to his ministerial staff. He doesn't even want his office repainted or renovated. He's dead set on, we're going to make peace. Don't distract me from it with other things. One of the ways to go about that is to prevent the spread of settlements. So, despite the threat of settler violence, he ordered Housing Minister Binyamin Ben Eliezer, Fahud Ben Eliezer, to halt construction in the territories. They froze the contracts on 7,000 units and intended to cancel them. And there were no more subsidies or incentives for moving across the Green Line. Now, ultimately, not all those contracts were voided because there were legal issues that the government could not entirely undo the promises made to construction companies and to individual citizens who had put in bids before June of 1992. But to the extent that he could stop building in the settlements, he did. And by the way, largely did not distinguish between political settlements and security settlements. Although in theory, in the long run, he believed that security settlements in the Jordan Valley or in the Jerusalem corridor would remain, whereas political settlements in the Shomron or Gaza would go, when it came to stopping construction, it was across the board. Okay.
What was the public opinion about this?
Obviously, those people who were interested in moving to the territories were not in favor. But for the most part, the center and left side of the political spectrum were in agreement with this. Okay. He said, for the sake of 3.9 million Israeli Jews and a million Israeli Arabs, we should not have to mortgage their future because of 100,000 settlers in the territories. That was his argument. So this was a very anti-settler administration. And he made no bones about it. This angered the people in Yesha to the point that Rabin was the devil. And bad things could happen. Bad things did happen. Now, who else did Rabin alienate? Well, AIPAC. Let's talk about that for a second. Rabin did not like when American Jews, or for that matter, diaspora Jews more generally, got involved in lobbying on behalf of Israel because he believed that Israeli diplomacy done at the highest levels took care of that for the state. And they didn't need thousands and thousands of well-wishers abroad mixing in where they don't belong. In the late 60s, early 70s, Rabin was a very effective ambassador to the United States from the State of Israel. And he didn't care what American Jews had to say for the most part. He was going to reach the highest levels of power and say his piece and make it a compelling case. But he doesn't want the lay people or some political action committee interfering. Also, he felt, and I think he was correct in this assessment, that AIPAC is a right-wing organization. AIPAC today is definitely a right-wing organization. Okay, who goes to the conference every March?
Rabbi Billa.
All right, well, it's dominated by knitted yarmulke-wearing Jews who go to Orthodox synagogues and who vote in absentia for Likud or for the Union of Right-Wing Parties. So, therefore, if you're a Labor prime minister looking to make peace and you're suspicious that AIPAC was in lockstep with the Shamir administration 5 seconds ago, that they're still going to harbor right-wing sentiment, and they're not going to be supportive of your peace overtures. Okay.
It coincides with their right-wing domestic policies.
Well, those Jews who are active politically, It's no longer a case of Jew equals liberal Democrat. As the 20th century came to a close, you have more and more Jews who are politically on the other side of the aisle. Okay, so the Bush administration wanted Rabin to focus on Syria because they didn't think that he was going to make any headway with the Palestinians, since Rabin at first was rejecting the idea of negotiating with the PLO. Rabin didn't think there was any point in talking to the Syrians because he thought that Assad was not likely to budge, and he was right. But to make the Americans happy, he made some overtures in the summer of 1992 towards the Syrians. When that failed, he went back towards the Palestinian route, except that now he had lost precious time. Well, what do you mean he lost precious time? It's 27 years later and there's still no peace. Well, who cares? You know? The answer is he made a promise. He made a promise that within 6 to 9 months he was going to sign some kind of an arrangement with the local Palestinians. So every day the clock is ticking towards an arbitrarily set deadline of his own making. All right. Well, there were talks going on in Washington, but they really were going nowhere. And these talks were a follow-up to the Madrid Conference of 1991, of October of 91. And why were they going nowhere? So they can be explained very easily. There are four partners, there are four other parties aside from Israel. There's Syria, there's Lebanon, there's Jordan, and there are the Palestinians. The reason why things are going nowhere is because the Syrians, led by Assad, are not interested in making peace, and certainly not unless they get every inch of the territories, including parts of Israel proper that they held between 1949 and 1967 on the border with the Kinneret Lake. And since nothing was going on with Syria because they're asking for too much, perforce nothing is going to happen with Lebanon because Lebanon is a proxy, is a patsy to the Syrians. And nothing's going on with the Palestinians because really they're beholden to the PLO and Israel won't negotiate with the PLO. And nothing's going to happen with Jordan because Jordan can't go before the Palestinians. It has to come after the Palestinians, which we'll see tonight. Once a deal with the PLO is in place, a deal with Jordan becomes inevitable almost immediately. Nothing was holding it up other than they had to go second. They couldn't come before the Palestinians. So the Washington talks are going nowhere. If that's true, how do you advance the ball? The answer is an accident. That the Norwegian social scientist named Terje Rod Larsen happened to bump into Yossi Beilin, and they're talking, and Beilin decides that it's illegal for Israelis to have contact with the PLO, so we'll have to do this unofficially in secret in a private location in Scandinavia, and we'll send non-government employees, we'll send academics. Which academics? Ron Pundak and Yair Hirschfeld. Okay, they were professors of sociology. I think one was at Haifa and one was at Hebrew U. Well, who are they meeting with? Representatives of the PLO. Abu Mazen, Abu Ala. And eventually, the law is changed on January 19th, 1993, the day before Clinton is inaugurated, that it's no longer illegal for Israelis to have contact with the PLO. I'm not really sure why the Knesset changed this law or what were the politics behind the change in law, but it was clear that if you're going to change the law to make it kosher, people are going to do it. People were doing it even when it wasn't kosher, but it was sort of it had to be unofficial. So the talks are continuing. Meantime, warm relations are developing between Yitzhak Rabin and Bill Clinton. This was a bit unexpected. Why was it unexpected?
Different type of people.
So Rabin is a general. Clinton is a draft dodger. Okay? Rabin was 71 years old. Clinton was 46. They're different in many, many ways. Plus, Rabin had supported the re-election of George Bush, contrary to the wishes of most American Jews. Sometimes. Okay, well, in this case, they developed a very strong, sincere relationship, and the Americans could serve as a helpful go-between if peace with the Palestinians was on the horizon. Now, the talks in Washington, which I said were going nowhere, were continued for the purpose of providing a cover for the real talks going on in Oslo. But the guys doing the talking in Washington didn't know about the talks going on in Oslo. And when they later found out about it, they were not happy. I could use a stronger word, but this is a family show. All right. And the Palestinians included were very upset by it. Who were the Palestinians? Hanan Ashrawi, okay, and Faisal Husseini. Because they were not formally PLO. although they were always conversing with Tunis after every conversation. They were angry eventually when the Declaration of Principles was signed, because they said, this must have been signed by people who don't live under Israeli occupation, who live in the diaspora, since the issues of Jerusalem and settlement construction were not included. And we who live under the Israeli boot, we know the real issue is settlement construction and the Judaizing of Jerusalem, whereas Arafat and Abu Mazen, who are 1,000 miles away in Tunis, they don't really know what they're doing. They signed a bad document. So there was ill will in the Palestinian camp over how there were two parallel sets of negotiations and one beat out the other and produced a document that the other side didn't like. Okay. Well, in Israel, Rabin doesn't know much about Oslo at first. It's under Balin and Peres. But eventually, Peres has to include Rabin in these whole discussions, and then Rabin muscles out Peres and takes over. In August of 1993, this becomes public knowledge. By the way, along the route between January and August, there were times when things broke down, and there needed to be certain intermediaries, intercessors, to smooth things out. One of them, of all people, was Ahmed Tibi. Who's Ahmed Tibi? So he's a member of Knesset, Arab member of Knesset, a former gynecologist, lives in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, and you're all around, like, funny guy. I mean, I happen to think he's quite a interesting character. He speaks a better Hebrew than anyone in this shul, and he'll correct you on any grammatical error you make in his presence. So he knew Arafat, and at one point Rabin sent Chaim Ramon to go to Ahmed Tibi, to go to Arafat to answer certain questions about the proposals. So we see that because there's no direct contact, sometimes you have to use odd people in between to get the message across. Okay, well, we're ready to sign some kind of document. It's getting to be September of 1993. And Rabin is under the gun to make a deal fast. Why? Because his government might collapse anytime soon. Why is it going to collapse? Well, remember, he only has the support of 62 members of Knesset plus the 5 Arabs on the side. But the 5 Arabs on the side, you really can't trust them because traditionally Arabs are not included in a coalition government. Shas was the third member of the government. They're about to resign. Why is Shas going to resign? So it's not over matters of religion and state. It's not over Shulamit Aloni being an apikoros. No. It's over Aryeh Deri potentially going to jail. Why? Because he stole money. Well, he took bribes. As the Minister of the Interior, he took $155,000 in bribes. In May, he had to resign from the Ministry of the Interior. In June, they brought him back. Then the thing went back to court. And finally, in September, there was an agreement that he would resign from the cabinet. And the other members of Shas who were in the cabinet in ministries and deputy ministries would also resign. And that the government was now going to be a minority government with reliance on Arab members from the outside. Well, if that's the case, maybe you can't pass in Knesset a deal signed with the PLO. You got to hurry up before it's too late. Now, do you have to pass in Knesset a deal signed with the PLO? Constitutionally, is that required?
There's no constitution.
To make things up as we go along. Okay? So, Rabin was very clear. This doesn't have to pass in the Knesset. However, we will go for approval, and we will regard a rejection of this declaration of principles with the PLO to be a motion of no confidence, resulting in new election and the end of this regime to be possibly renewed under a better and stronger mandate. So Rabin is taking a chance that it will pass. Well, you have the signing ceremony on the lawn, September 13th, 1993, before it goes to the Knesset. First you have the big ceremony with Clinton, and then it goes to the vote. The ceremony with Clinton almost didn't happen. In fact, Rabin didn't want it to happen. He did not want to have a face-to-face encounter with Arafat. And I can't blame him. I mean, who wants to meet Yasser Arafat? The guy is evil. But Clinton wanted it. And Clinton extended an invitation to both parties. And Arafat said yes first. And once Arafat said yes, there was no way Rabin was going to allow Arafat to have the sole spotlight together with Clinton in front of the Western world. He was going to have to go. So he agreed to go. The next question is, well, what's Arafat going to wear? Are we going to have a repeat of 1974 at the UN? So Rabin said, no gun and no uniform. So Clinton was able to get Arafat to agree, no gun. But as for the uniform, Arafat insisted. So Clinton said to Rabin, just call it a safari suit. All right. That's it. Was a different time. No. Sue Arafat kissed Hillary Clinton, but it wasn't that incident. No. It was several years later that happened.
Did Rabin want to shake hands?
Okay, so Rabin did not want to shake hands with Arafat. If you look at the videotape, it's very clear that he was reluctant to do so. And it was a very weak handshake on the part of Rabin. And then he said to Perez, now it's your turn. He dragged Perez over. You got to shake hands with him too. Which brings us to Perez. If you remember, if you were watching on TV, and you remember it's 26 years ago already, but I remember it. I was watching on TV. It was in 7th grade, North Shore Hebrew Academy. They brought us to the big screen. I can't believe Rabbi Rabinowitz actually did that. I'm surprised, because he was, you know, not of that sort. But who spoke at that event? Bill Clinton, Yasser Arafat, Yitzhak Rabin, and Shimon Peres and Abu Mazen. Why did Shimon Peres and Abu Mazen speak? Why do the foreign ministers, respectively, speak at an event where typically the host would speak and the various heads of government would speak? The answer is, Peres was annoyed with Rabin in the first week or two of September that he was being overshadowed by the events and by the Prime Minister, despite the fact that this all was his doing to begin with. That if not for Peres and Balin, there would be no Oslo. And so when he was not consulted over any of the final details, he threatened to resign. He mumbled under his breath to certain of his underlings, and word got back to Rabin, Shimon's about to resign. And Rabin did not want to have a cabinet crisis, and it would have been a real crisis, right on the verge of going to the White House. So he had to placate Shimon and said, fine, you're going to have a speaking role. So he did, and therefore the event went longer than it should have. All right, so this signing ceremony went well. It almost didn't happen at all. 20 minutes before they were set to go on stage, Arafat insisted upon one last revision, that instead of the Palestinians, the wording would be the Palestine Liberation Organization, because Arafat feared that a declaration of principles signed between Israel and him might end up being twisted to mean a deal between Israel and the Palestinians as a broad and amorphous entity and not the PLO as a formal organization, and then he'd be kicked out in favor of some local representation in the West Bank. So he insisted upon the change. Rabin was not happy about it, but Rabin's underling said, listen, Yitzchak, you got to do it because in 20 minutes we're going on stage and you don't want to be the reason why we have to cancel this whole charade. So they agreed to it. Okay. Well, Rabin had a problem. He has to convince the Knesset to go along with this, but terror hasn't gone away. There still is the occasional outburst of Palestinian anti-Jewish violence. So he has to come up with some kind of a slogan to justify continued peace process and peace efforts, even though on the ground, peace is not readily apparent. So he has a slogan that says, we will fight terror as if there are no peace talks, and conduct peace talks if there's no terror. Now he ripped that off of whom? Off of David Ben-Gurion. We're going to fight the white paper like there are no Nazis, and we're going to fight the Nazis like there's no white paper. Okay? So sometimes you steal from the best. All right. But getting back to the Knesset approval. So had the government included Shas, which it no longer did because they were out a week earlier, the vote might have been 67 to 53. The 62 members of the government plus the 5 Arabs against the 53 members of the right religious bloc. As it turned out, the final vote was 61 to 50 to 8. 8 abstentions. Who abstained? Shas, their 6 representatives abstained. Why? Because Rabbi Ovadia Yosef told them to abstain. Now, Derry later claimed that he wanted to vote against the peace process, but that the Rebbe Avadia, who's the boss, said, you don't want to do that to Shimon and to Yitzchak at the top. Abstain. It's a, you know, play neutral. Right, so Derry can't really be trusted with the truth. He was more dovish, and I believe he would have wanted to vote in favor. And had he not had to resign from the cabinet because of his own theft, he would have voted for Oslo, I believe. It's only because he was no longer in the cabinet that he then had some wiggle room, but Rebbe Avadia said, abstain and don't vote for or against. He was dovish, which could explain why they didn't vote against it. Abstaining is the same thing really as voting in favor, because as long as you have the requisite number for it to pass, then your non-vote is lo malav lo morid. Okay?
Can you explain this to this day?
Who are you, Derry?
Derry,
he's a good politician. And by the way, you should know that for all of his crookedness, even his detractors will admit that he was a very good Minister of the Interior. He got that job at the age of 29 in 1988, and held that job for 5 years, and did a very, very good job. Even people, secularists who don't like him on any grounds, religious or otherwise, will admit he was a very good government functionary, and he's a good wheeler dealer. Okay, so who else abstained? I said it was 61 to 50 to 8, and Shas has 6 seats. The answer is that Likud did not have a united front. Likud was in a jam here, because they realize there are 61 votes, this will pass, there will be a relationship between Israel and the PLO, and Lu Yitzuyer, if the one day Likud will win an election, what are they going to do? How are they going to relate to the Oslo Accords? Are they going to say we're abrogating them unilaterally? Or are they going to say, well, they were signed by a legitimate government of Israel, we have to live with it? Ultimately, what happens? Netanyahu was elected in 1996, and it stays in place. He has to accept that a sovereign Israeli government signed a deal, you can't break it. So already in 1993, Meir Shitrit and Rani Milo, two young and significant members of the Likud Knesset faction, say, we're going to have to live with this. And you know what? Peace is not a bad idea. So, we'll abstain. We won't vote in favor, but we'll abstain. By the way, what else might a Likudnik say in favor of Oslo? A Likudnik could honestly say that Oslo is really a Likud idea. Because what was Oslo? It was not Palestinian statehood. It was autonomy in a small portion of the West Bank that happened to be with the PLO, as opposed to with local Palestinian Arabs. But basically, if you put aside the issue of who the other party was, on the content of it, Oslo really is a successor to Menachem Begin's Camp David autonomy for the Palestinians. It is not a merits dovish Palestinian state in 100% of the territories kind of scenario, the likes of which Barak and Olmert would later contemplate. But in 1993, a strong case could be made that a centrist Likudnik would really not see a problem with Oslo, other than the fact that it's the PLO and it's Rabin who did it. Okay. So,
in that ultimate direction of having the 1947 resolution 181.
It depends who you ask. Some would argue, in hindsight, that it was inevitable that when you sign a deal with the PLO over autonomy and you postpone the significant issues until a final status arrangement, that final status arrangement, if it will ever come to exist, will have to be Palestinian statehood. I would argue that point of view is correct, which is also why I've been saying for 20 years that there never will be a final status arrangement. Because it's so unfathomable it can't happen. All right. Now, who's trying to derail this process? After it's signed and after it's passed by the Knesset, what political factions within Israel and within the territories are looking to derail this. Huh? Extremists. What kind of extremists?
Communists.
So Jewish right-wing extremists, and who else? Hamas. Islamic Jihad. So Hamas and Islamic Jihad are not bound by any of this. Okay, they're free to do whatever they want, and they will do whatever they want, and they'll use the peace process as a convenient excuse to kill more Jews. The question is, what will Yasser Arafat do about it? And that will be the major bone of contention between the Israeli center and the Israeli left over the next 7 years, up until Netanyahu loses to Barak in 99. That basically the center is saying there has to be reciprocity. And the left is saying, well, Arafat might not be able to deliver on reciprocity because he doesn't control his extremists. They're not his. They're other factions. And if he tries to, by military means, by violent means, crack down on the extremists in his camp, he'll have a civil war and we'll have no peace process because we'll just have Palestinian civil war. That's the excuse-making that the Israeli left made towards the Israeli center. Now, I ignore the Israeli right because the Israeli right doesn't even care about reciprocity. They just don't want any deals whatsoever. They oppose Oslo absolutely and completely. That's Netanyahu's approach, and the Likud is strong against Oslo from 93 through 95. But as the next election rolls around, and there's a need to make a more moderate face for the general public, even Netanyahu will do what Shitrit and Milo had done and say, all right, fine, Oslo exists, we're going to have to reconcile with it. Okay. So, in February of 94, things fall apart. There's violence on both sides. What happens? Baruch Goldstein kills a bunch of Arabs. And there are several suicide bombings in Afula and elsewhere in Israel. And the knife attacks don't stop either. So when the process grinds to a halt, you need somebody to reignite it, to get the ball rolling again. And as it turned out, Yasser Arafat called Yitzhak Rabin on the phone one day, and they didn't believe it was Arafat. It was one of these things, they thought it was a prank call. And they didn't patch it through. And the secretary later told Rabin, there's some guy claiming to be Arafat called an hour ago. He says, why didn't you put it through? So he calls him back. They meet in Cairo on May 4th, 1994, and they sign the Cairo Agreement. The Cairo Agreement is what's known as the Jericho-Gaza Agreement. So if you remember from 25 years ago, the Jericho-Gaza Agreement is what allowed the PLO apparatus and hierarchy to leave Tunis and move back to Eretz Yisrael, to Gaza primarily, and some went to Jericho. Why there, of all places? Can you explain why Gaza and Jericho?
Jericho is very placid and not very radical.
Okay, that's an important point, yes. What else? Okay, good. So Gaza, nobody cares about Gaza. It's a very important thing. In world diplomacy, you always remember, nobody cares about Gaza. It was easier to walk away from parts of, although not all of Gaza, in 1994, than it would be to walk away from the heartland of Judea and Samaria, from a Zionist ideological point of view. So it's convenient in that respect. Also, it is smaller. Also, there are almost no Jews living there. Also, it's contained. It's surrounded. It's from a security point of view, it's easy to block off. So Gaza will be an experiment. Can the PLO behave decently and govern in Gaza? And if they can, then what? We'll think about further withdrawals in the West Bank. Remember, this is a multi-stage process. So why Jericho? Because what does Arafat suspect of the Israelis? That Gaza first is really Gaza only. So in order to alleviate him of that worry, they had to throw some element of the West Bank his way. What are they going to throw his way? The easiest thing is Jericho. At first, Rabin rebuffed the idea, saying Jericho is a closed military zone, blah, 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 the Jordan Valley, it's going to belong to Israel. But then he changed his tune. And he recognized, number one, the population there is fairly docile. They're not the radicals like Hebron or Jenin. or Shechem. Also, Jericho was always conceived of as Arab territory that would go to whatever Arab entity controls the heartland of the West Bank in the Alon Plan. Remember the old Alon Plan from 1970? So the Alon Plan was the Labor Party's base of operations for years, that Israel will retain the Jordan Valley, Israel will retain the Jerusalem Corridor, Israel will retain part of the Judean Desert, but that the highlands of Samaria up to the Green Line, and that the highlands of Judea south of Beit Lechem would go to the Arabs, presumably to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. And it will be connected to Jordan via Jericho. So Jericho was always going to go to the Arabs. Now, it's the PLO, it's not the state of Jordan. So, out fine, you give them Jericho. You surround it, make sure nobody gets out and misbehaves, and make a casino out of Shalom Al Yisrael. Okay? So that was the idea. What happens next? So, in early July, Arafat leaves Tunis, arrives in Gaza, and then makes his way to Jericho. So July of 94 is when the Palestinian Authority begins in earnest. It takes some time from September of 93 with the signing of the principles until you could put it into practice. Okay. Now, certain things happen in between September of 93 and Arafat's arrival. Notably, in December of 93, Zuart Seinu was established by a fellow from this neighborhood. What's his name? Sackett. Shmuel Sackett. Together with Moshe Feiglin, who didn't make the Knesset this time. And the joke was, Zehut, and then drop the tough, Zehu, it's over. Yeah. So they founded Zuart Seinu, and they believed in civil disobedience, blocking roads, and getting arrested, and doing all sorts of mishigasin to prevent any withdrawals. So the question is, they were like on the fringe, but among the main right-wing politicians, did people support that kind of behavior? The answer is, some did and some didn't. Benny Begin, who you cannot accuse of being a softie, was against civil disobedience, was against any form of illegality, and said, when you see Yitzhak Rabin on the street, you confront him peaceably, with the dignity owed to the Prime Minister of the State of Israel. But you ask him questions. Eifo HaShalom, where's the peace? But that's Begin for you. Others were a bit more rambunctious. Who was among the Likud Knesset faction most rambunctious in favor of wild activities? Ron Nachman, of blessed memory, the longtime mayor of Ariel, who came to the Great Nick Synagogue in 1994 to rail against Oslo, and I remember that he's a Kohen. And how do I remember that he was a Kohen? Because I was the Balkore, and he got an Aliyah in the Great Nick Synagogue. I remember, and then he spoke anti-Oslo. Good memories from the 1990s. So, so there were people in the Knesset who said, we gotta disrupt things, we gotta cause trouble. So in 1994, late in the year, Rabin, Peres, and Arafat are nominated and win the Nobel Peace Prize. But right around that time, there's a kidnapping. Of whom? Of Nachshon Waxman. And for a while, they didn't know where he was. This was not like a one-day thing. This was a protracted episode, sadly. And the price that Hamas was insisting upon was the release of Sheikh Yassin, Ahmed Yassin, the blind sheikh. And Rabin wouldn't do it. Rabin would not do it. In the end, he pressured Arafat, you got to find where they're keeping the prisoner. And supposedly Arafat helped in finding where the house was. Sadly, the end was that Waxman was killed and in a firefight, but probably before the firefight, that ended up killing a bunch of Hamas operatives as well. And Rabin said, I would have gladly given up the Peace Prize to save Waxman's life. Like it was weighing on him as he went to Scandinavia to get the award. That this is nonsense. These awards don't mean anything. What matters is human life. And so he was very much troubled by the whole thing. What about Peres and Rabin? They're collaborating on this venture of Oslo, but they don't like each other. For a long time, they've hated each other's guts. there are those who say that they developed something of a friendship, a thaw in the relationship, a thaw, after Peres fell on the ice. What happened? At Oslo, Peres took a header. He fell on his face at a huge black and blue mark right after the ceremony. And Rabin visited him in the emergency room and was nice to him. And Yesh Omrim, that from that day forward, for the next 10 months, as long as Rabin was alive, they were no longer enemies. They were somewhat of friends. Okay. Now, Oslo 2 was much more controversial than Oslo 1. Why? Because there's more at stake. Oslo 1 was just a declaration of principles that included within it a promise about Gaza and Jericho. But Oslo 2, in the summer of 1995, was about withdrawal from the major West Bank cities. Which ones? Let's go from north to south. So, Jenin, Shechem, Ramallah, Beit Lechem, not Hebron, Tul Karim, and Kalkilia. And why do they call it Kalkilia? Because they'll kill you. So six cities, not Hebron. Not Hebron. That was delayed until the Netanyahu administration, 1997. And why? Because it's too controversial. And Jews live there. It's the whole story. So this was the creation of what we know today. Area A, B, and C. With Area A being the major West Bank cities. So this is a significant withdrawal of IDF forces from a large swath of territory in the West Bank. And it's going to be a major controversy. So it was negotiated by the various foreign ministers, by Peres and Abu Mazen. And Peres then told Rabin on September 23rd, 1995, you either accept this deal as I've negotiated it now without demanding any further revision, or I will run against you in the party primary next year. Meaning, I've gotten them to go as far as they're going to go. Don't mess this up now. And Rabin was taken aback. You're going to run against me in the party primary? Fine, we'll go for it. And it was signed at the White House on September 28th, 1995. But again, the signing always happens before the Knesset vote. And this vote is going to be the most controversial vote in the history of the Israeli parliament. Because the final tally would be 61 to 59. And how do you get the 61 votes? Okay, so assuming Shas is out, and they are, the government was down to 56 people, plus the support of five Arabs. But Labor lost two of its members. Which two? Emmanuel Zisman, who you probably never heard of, and then another one who you did hear of, or I assume you heard of, Avigdor Kahalani. Now, Avigdor Kahalani is a national hero. He single-handedly won the Yom Kippur War for Israel by pushing back the Syrians in the Golan Heights. Okay, a legitimate war hero, an important public figure. And he made it known that he didn't like this withdrawal. He didn't like the fact that Rabin was pushing forward too quickly on peace deals while Arafat had yet to revise the PLO charter calling for the destruction of Israel, had not really cracked down on Palestinian terrorism from the other factions, that Israel was getting nothing in return, at least nothing tangible, and Eifo HaShalom, where's the peace? So Kahalani and Zisman broke away from the party, and they formed the Third Way. Remember the Third Way? It tried to be a centrist party in the mid-1990s. It never really had any success. Their big deal was Rabin also was talking about giving away the Golan Heights to Syria. And Kahalani equals Mr. Golan Heights. So the Third Way represented a cautious approach on the Palestinian front and an absolute no on the Syrian Golan front. So if you lose two guys to the center, to the right block, that means you're down to 59 votes. Well, how do you get to above the threshold? How do you get to 61? The answer is, for those of you who were here last week, I said that Tzomet was the party of Raful Eitan, and that Tzomet was basically like a good government party along the lines of Shinui/Meretz, except that unlike Shinui Meretz's naive, radical left-wing approach towards the Palestinians, Tzomet was a hard-line, not-one-inch kind of party. Rafu Leitan, a tough guy. But that socially, they were really on the labor side of things. They were kibbutzniks, moshavniks. And I said that Rafu Leitan was a faction of eight, where it was him and the seven dwarfs. The other seven were complete nobodies. Well, the problem in the Knesset is, even if you're a nobody, once you're elected, you're a somebody. And if you don't like what your party is doing because the leader is too authoritarian, what can you do? You can create your own faction. And so, in the beginning of 1994, the Yehud faction breaks away from Tzomet. And they are three people. They are Alex Goldfarb, Gonen Segev, and Esther Salmanovitz. Now, Gonen Segev has been in the news lately. For what? For spying for Iran. Okay, Gonen Segev is like a traitor. He's a traitor. He's a former physician who was peddling drugs, like in the ecstasy on the open market. He's committed every crime in the book and been to jail twice, and committed espionage for Iran, and was once a government minister. So, he and the other two joined the government in the beginning of 1995. And they were given government positions. Okay, Goldfarb was deputy housing minister, and Segev became minister of energy. These folks voted for the Oslo II Accords and got the left side of the aisle over the hump to 61 votes. In the retelling of the story, which is not entirely accurate, but is what everybody who reads this stuff knows, because that's what they've been told for the last 20 years, how was Oslo II passed? By bribing Alex Goldfarb with a Mitsubishi and a driver. That he voted for it, that he was a nobody, he was an electrician by trade, snuck his way into the Knesset under the Tzomet, became part of Yehud, and for a Mitsubishi and a driver with a bribe, was willing to vote for the most important vote in the history of the Knesset. Now, that's not really what happened. What really happened was, he got a Mitsubishi and a driver when he became deputy housing minister in January of 1995, 8.5 months before, or 9 months before, the vote on Oslo II. But in the right-wing revisionist retelling of the story, he sold his soul to the devil for a Mitsubishi and a driver. He's still alive, Alex Goldfarb, and to this day he's harassed by right-wing Israelis for his having been a traitor. Okay. So this is how the deal passed muster. What I can say about in the few minutes we have left, but the Rabin administration, is that there were some highlights, some good things that had nothing to do with the peace process. First of all, there was a rapid number of increase in population at that time from the Russian Aliyah, and a large increase in the number of cars in Israel, and material prosperity. And so Rabin's administration spent a lot of money on infrastructure to build roads. All the major highways that you see in Israel today, in Israel proper especially, other than the handful that were built in the last 10 years, were mostly built in the mid-1990s, when Rabin was prime minister. Before that, really, it was tough to get around. And the reason why there was money made available is because when you don't have to spend money on building settlements in the middle of nowhere in the West Bank, what can you do? You can build a highway in Israel proper. What else did he do that was good? Education. The school day was lengthened and educational standards were dramatically increased. Also, there was a move towards rationalizing healthcare in Israel. And this had to do with the demise of the Histadrut, or the reorganizing of the Histadrut. That Chaim Ramon ran for the Histadrut chairmanship on a platform that you have to have national health insurance. And here, interestingly, the political alignment was very odd. Meretz and the left wing of labor were aligned with the Likud in favor of national health care. The core of labor and the hawkish members of labor opposed national health care because they wanted to preserve the old trade unionship of the Histadrut and the Kupat Cholim under the auspices of a private authority. So you have this odd scenario where the right wing and the far left believe in undoing the Yishuv era setup in favor of a national policy. Okay. Now, what else happened during the Rabin administration? So, an important thing was the shift from the National Religious Party to Shas in playing the role of junior coalition member concerned with matters of religion. That for the longest time, from the 1930s up until 1977, the National Religious Party was in every government, pretty much, and even in the pre-state era, in every pre-government government. And they got along well with Ben-Gurion, and with Sharet, and with Eshkol, and with Golda. They got their fiefdom of religious education, and they got their status quo, in terms of Kashrus and Shabbos and the like, okay? And all was well in the world. And they left the high politics for the Mapai, meaning matters of war and peace are largely decided by David Ben-Gurion, by Levi Eshkol, by Moshe Dayan, and not by the minor religious parties. The minor religious parties defer to the big boys on the high politics. As long as you give us our religious parochial concerns, we're good. Now, the National Religious Party changed its tune after 1977 and became a right-wing party that wanted its say on matters of war and peace and matters of the territories. We're going to build settlements. They became a hard right party. I mean, yes, there were some left-wingers even in the NRP, but it became a hard right party, and it cared about national politics. Shas, by entering the government in 92, it doesn't really have a say over matters of war and peace, or diplomacy, or defense issues. No. What does it care about? The religious status quo, its institutions, funding, and the like. So it behaved in 1992 and 93, 94 like the Mafdal did in 1954. Okay? But moreover, they now had all the goodies that the NRP used to have. Now, did Rabin try to undo the religious status quo? Rabin was a very secular guy. I mean, I think, who was it who said he was the most secular Jew I ever met? Was it Martin Indyk? One of the Americans, or Dennis Ross, maybe. One of the American Jewish State Department types. He's the most secular Jew I ever met. He did not undo the status quo. He, despite the fact that the NRP was not in government, he let the NRP-controlled religious education division remain intact, did not abolish it. He also went against the Supreme Court's ruling by having the Knesset pass a revised law forbidding the import of non-kosher meat. That the Supreme Court said you can't pass such a law, and he did it anyway. Because he said he didn't want to be the first Israeli prime minister to bring treif into the country. Rabin said that, okay? So he had the kind of relationship between Rabin and Derry could be compared to the relationship between Ben-Gurion and Rabbi Maimon, or Eshkol and Chaim Moshe Shapira, or Golda Meir and Yosef Burg, or Menachem Begin and Menachem Porush. That every prime minister had some religious politician who was their guy. And for Rabin, it was Aryeh Derry, for better or for worse. Okay. Another thing that Rabin wanted to do in his term was to destroy the foreign policy myth of Rak Halikud Yachol. What does Rak Halikud Yachol mean? Only Likud can do it. I mean, the left wing, the labor is too weak to make a real deal with the Arabs. And only a right winger can do it. What's the American equivalent? Nixon goes to China. All right. So he wanted to destroy that myth, and basically he did. Okay. The Likud miscalculated, and with this we'll conclude for tonight. The Likud miscalculated in how popular Oslo would be. Oslo was very popular in late 93, early 94. It became increasingly less popular as terrorism increased in 1995. But at least in the beginning, it had a strong backing. Now, Alex Goldfarb, the Schmendrick who voted for the 61st vote, he said, on why he voted yes, the citizens of Israel need to give peace a chance. Only time will tell what is justice. That was his excuse. But Netanyahu's response to Oslo II was, your giving of rights won't stop at some green line. From the Arab national perspective, the line of giving won't stop until it reaches the blue line, the line of the Mediterranean Sea. So, Was Bibi right? Yeah, probably. That Arab intentions were not especially peaceful, and that if you read between the lines, they had malice towards the Jews even after signing them on the dotted line. But Bibi did not understand, at least initially, that there is support for this, and people want to take some kind of a chance. Later, he would realize, okay, they want to take a chance, but a prudent chance, not a reckless chance. So next week, we'll discuss the assassination of Rabin and the 1996 election that followed, where Netanyahu learned his lesson, and his slogan was, Osim Shalom Batuach. We'll make a secure peace. Not no peace, a secure peace. See you next time.